this.
The Wars of the Roses started in 1455 and spread over 30 years. Various battles, sporadic skirmishes, not one long war. On one side was the House of Lancaster, on the other, the House of York. The houses of York and Lancaster were the same dynasty, the Plantagenets, the same family tree. And because we talk of Yorkists and Lancastrians, that doesn't mean that the wars were between Yorkshire and Lancashire. Noble titles had little to do with places, just as today the Duke of Norfolk's family seat is at Arundel in Sussex, so it was then, and so our story should not be taken as an indication of how various regions leaned towards or away from the king. So, who owned what? The Lancastrians were in power. Henry VI was a Lancastrian. His wife, Margaret, was French. And, because they ruled, they had crown lands, for example, the Duchy of Cornwall, and they had all the Lancastrian earldoms, Lancaster itself, Derby, Lincoln, Leicester, Hereford, Nottingham. The other families who supported them, the Beauforts, the de la Poles, and the Courtenays, gave them Somerset, Surrey, East Anglia, and Devon. Then, with the Percys and the elder Nevilles in the Lancastrian camp, they had control of the northern strongholds. The strength of the Yorkists was in the Mortimer family, and their lands were mainly on the Welsh borders, the Marches. They had strong support in Kent, some in Norfolk, and because of the younger Nevilles, the Earls of Warwick and Salisbury, Wiltshire and the southern Midlands. And, as we'll see, Richard Neville, Earl of Warwick, is very important to the first years of this story. The king had come to the throne when he was 9 months old, and so the barons, who actually ran the country on his behalf, became very powerful and factious. The English had been all but swept from France at the end of the Hundred Years' War, and there was an overwhelming recognition throughout England of incompetent government, maladministration, and corruption. And then, of course, there were the personal ambitions of the main players. None of these reasons by themselves accounts for the Wars of the Roses, but put them all together, and civil war seemed inevitable.
The 4 years from 1456 to 1459 were a period of uneasy truce. Solemn pledges of amity were exchanged. The sacrament was taken in common by all leaders. All sought peace where there was no peace. War began in earnest in July 1460. York was in Ireland. But the Yorkist lords under Warwick confronted the Lancastrians and the Crown at Northampton. Henry VI stood entrenched and new cannon guarded his line. But when the Yorkists attacked, Lord Grey of Riven, who commanded a wing, deserted him and helped the Yorkists over the breastworks. The royal forces fled in panic. King Henry VI remained in his tent. The victors presented themselves to him, bowing to the ground. They carried him to London, and having him in their power once more, ruled in his name. The Duke of York kept him at Westminster, till at last the king, for fear of death, granted him the crown. Henry was to be king for life. York was to conduct the government and succeed him at his death. But the settlement defied the fact that Queen Margaret, with her son the Prince of Wales, was at liberty at Harlech Castle in Wales. The queen fought on. With her army, Margaret advanced to assert the birthright of her son. The Duke of York marched against her. At Wakefield on December the 30th, 1460, the first considerable battle of war was fought. The Lancastrians, with superior forces, caught the Yorkists by surprise, and a frightful rout and massacre ensued. No quarter was given. The Duke of York was killed. His son, the Earl of Rutland, 17 years old, was flying, but the new Lord Clifford slaughtered him with joy, exclaiming, "By God's blood thy father slew mine, and so I will do thee and all thy kin." Henceforward, this was the rule of the war. The old Earl of Salisbury, caught during the night, was beheaded immediately by Lord Exeter. The heads of the three Yorkist nobles were exposed over the gates and walls of York. The great Duke's head with a paper crown grinned upon the landscape, summoning the Avengers.
The Queen's army marched south, taking its time, beat Warwick on the way, and recaptured the king. That should have been that. The Duke dead, the Yorkists humiliated, the House of Lancaster on the throne. But it wasn't. Edward, the Earl of March, the late Duke of York's eldest son, hoisted his father's banner. He took on the Queen's supporter, Jasper Tudor, beat him at Mortimer's Cross, and joined up bruised Warren in Oxfordshire. Together they entered an intrigue. A week after arrived in London, the Earl of March was ruling England, and the Queen was heading north. Edward caught up with her at Towton Field in Yorkshire, and in a snow blizzard slaughtered hundreds of Lancastrians. Henry VI escaped with his life, but not his throne. The 20-year-old Duke of York was crowned Edward IV, and one-third of the estates in England changed hands.
After Towton, the Lancastrian cause was sustained by the unconquerable will of Queen Margaret. Never has her tenacity, and rarely have her vicissitudes, been surpassed by any woman. Apart from the sullen power of Lancaster in the north, she had the friendly regard of two countries, Scotland and France. Both had felt the heavy arm of England in former reigns. Both rejoiced at its present division and weakness. When Margaret returned with fresh succours from France and Scotland in 1463, Percy opened the gates of Bamburgh Castle to the Scots, and Alnwick Castle was betrayed by a soured Yorkist. Meanwhile, Queen Margaret, with King Henry in her hands, herself besieged the castle at Norham on the Tweed, near Berwick. Once again, Edward and the Yorkists took the field, and the redoubtable new artillery was carried north. The great guns blew chunks off the castles. Margaret fled to France, while Henry buried himself amid the valleys and the pious foundations of Cumberland. This was the parting of King Henry VI and his queen. Margaret remained held at Bar-le-Duc. Poor King Henry was at length tracked down near Clitheroe in Lancashire and conveyed to London. This time there was no ceremonial entry. With his feet tied by leather thongs to the stirrups, and with a straw hat on his head, the futile but saintly figure around whom such storms had beaten was led three times round the pillory and finally hustled to the Tower.
This was all in 1465, and once again we might have thought the Wars of the Roses were over. The Queen was penniless in France. The King was in the war. What could harm the Yorkist cause? The answer, Yorkists themselves. More important, the new King, Edward IV, and his kingmaker, Richard Neville, the Earl of Warwick. From 1460, the Nevilles were virtually running the country. Warwick, who could see the political advantages for doing so, planned to marry the king to a French princess. He made all the diplomatic arrangements, but the king was reluctant to commit himself. Then the reason came out. The king was already married. Warwick was outraged. What had happened? Edward had married Elizabeth Woodville, the widow of the Lancastrian Lord Grey. Not very political, not very diplomatic, but he loved her. They knew their opposition, and so they kept their wedding secret for 5 months, until Warwick forced the issue.
His bride, Queen Elizabeth, had 5 brothers, 7 sisters, and 2 sons. By royal decree, he raised them to high rank, or married them into the greatest families. He went so far as to marry his wife's 4th brother, at 20, to the Dowager Duchess of Norfolk, aged 80. 8 new peerages came into existence in the Queen's family. Her father, 5 brothers-in-law, her son, and her brother Anthony.
Just think what this meant in terms of power. 8 new peerages. There were only 60 peers in the whole of England. Warwick's grip on the king had been weakened by one smile from the widow of a Castrian knight.
But the clash came over foreign policy. It was the policy of Warwick to make friends with France, by far the stronger power, and thus obtain effectual security. In this mood, he hoped to make a French match for the king's sister. Edward took the opposite line. Amid his revelries and other hunting, he nursed a conqueror's spirit. Never should England become a vassal state. Instead of being divided by her neighbours, she would herself, by dividing them, maintain the balance. The king, therefore, to Warwick's chagrin and alarm, in 1468, married his eldest sister Margaret to Charles the Bold, who had in 1467 succeeded as Duke of Burgundy. Thus, not only did the great lords, who at the constant peril of their lives and by all their vast resources had placed him on the throne, suffer the slights and the material losses by creation of a new nobility, But they had, besides, to stomach a foreign policy which they believed would be fatal to England, to the Yorkist party, and to themselves. What help could Burgundy give if France, joined to the House of Lancaster, invaded England? What would happen to them, their great estates? The quarrel between the king and Warwick, as head of the Nevilles, was not therefore petty. Edward's attention in public matters was occupied mainly with Lancastrian plots, but underneath and behind him a far graver menace was preparing. Warwick had gained the king's brother Clarence to his side by whispering that but for this upstart brood of Woodvilles, he might succeed Edward as king. As bond, it was secretly agreed that Clarence should marry Warwick's daughter, Isabella.
In the summer of 1469, a rebellion broke out in the north. The contrived complaint was too high taxes and too much favouritism. While this was going on, the marriage between Clarence and Isabella, which had been forbidden by the king, took place at Calais. They, Clarence and Warwick, returned to England, and royalists and rebels met at the Battle of Edgecote. The royalists fell, and the king's two supporters, the Earls of Pembroke and Devon, were beheaded. The king, trying to rally his scattered forces, was captured. Warwick now had two kings at his mercy. Don't forget, Henry VI was still a prisoner.
Warwick had struck with suddenness, and for a while no one realised what had happened. As the truth became known, the Yorkist nobility viewed with astonishment and anger the detention of their brave sovereign, and the Lancastrians raised their heads in the hopes of profiting by the Yorkist feud. The king found it convenient to dissemble. He professed himself convinced that Warwick and Clarence were right. He undertook to mend his ways, and after he had signed free pardons to all who had been in arms against him, he was liberated.
Within a few months, there was another rising, this one in Lincolnshire. But this time, the king survived, and Warwick and Clarence, who were now exposed, left England. In France, Louis XI forced Warwick to negotiate with the exiled queen, Margaret of Anjou. She agreed to a marriage between her son, Prince Edward, and Warwick's daughter, Anne Neville. Their plan was that Margaret's son would one day be king and Warwick's daughter queen. But first, they had to get rid of Edward and restore the imprisoned Henry VI to the throne.